This is the third shiur in the Kunches HaChesed of Tesla. Okay, yesterday we were talking about the motivation of giving. And we said that, of course, to give means to give to someone who has to receive. But that doesn't mean that the receiver has to have a selfish motivation. Both the giver and the receiver can have motivation of giving. The receiver can have as his motivation giving the other person the opportunity to give. And when that happens, both sides feel that they have given, and both sides feel a benefit in the fact that they've given. They feel fulfilled in the fact that they have given. Flippant example, imagine that you are working, lobbying for a bill in Congress that's very important to you, and you finally get it passed, and President Bush is going to sign it into law, and you're invited to the signing ceremony. And President Bush takes out his pen, starts to sign it, and in the middle of signing his signature, his pen runs out of ink. So he says, "Oh, does anybody have a pen?" And you say, "Yes, Mr. President, yes, here, use my pen. Use my pen." He says, "Thanks." And he finishes signing his signature, and he hands you the pen back. He says, "No, no, keep it, Mr. President. Keep it. It's a present from me. Keep it." Right? Now, what happened over here? Well, he got the free use of a pen. Right? What you got is, your pen was used for the president's signature of a piece of United States legislation. You'll tell this to your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. If this is a photographer who's taking the picture, you know, you'll put that up on your wall. So both sides are benefiting here. Both sides are benefiting here. You gave the pen, and he, by receiving the pen from you, gave you the opportunity to participate in a very important event. This principle is codified in halacha, in Jewish law. Okay, a couple of guys here with black hats. You know where? It's a Gemara. It's an open Gemara. It's exactly what I told you, only I dressed it up with President Bush. In marriage, how is a marriage contracted? The man must give something of value to the woman. Ask the Gemara, what will happen if it would be the opposite way? But she gives him something. Will the marriage be valid? The Gemara says, in general, no. It has to be that the man is giving something of value to the woman. Except, Adam Choshev Shani. If the man is a very important person, then it could be that when she gives him the item, she becomes married to him. How does that work? Let's say she wants to give him a watch. The watch is worth $500. But this is the king. And she would like the king to wear the watch that she's giving, right? Suppose she knows that the king is not inclined to accept presents. But she knows the prime minister very well. Might she not go to the prime minister and say, "Listen, I'm offering you $1,000. Go and convince the king to receive the watch for me. It's worth $1,000 to me that you should convince him to accept the present for me." So she's investing $1,500 in the present. Doesn't matter to her. She wants him to have it and wear it. Good. Now suppose the prime minister says, "I know my services are worth $1,000, and for other people I would definitely charge $1,000 to do such a thing. But for you, I'll do it for nothing." Isn't she receiving $1,000 service for nothing? That's not tin, as my father Al-Rajan would say. That's not worthless. She's receiving $1,000 of service for nothing. Now she goes directly to the king. Doesn't bother the prime minister. But she'd be willing to pay anybody $1,000 to get him to receive it. She offers it to him, and he receives it. Isn't she getting $1,000 worth of value? She's giving a $500 watch and getting $1,000 worth of value. So she's the recipient here. She's the beneficiary. And that's why she's married. She's married because the very fact of accepting the watch from her, he's giving her a present of more value than the watch itself. So that in this transaction, she comes out to be the winner. See, it's a beautiful example of both sides giving to the other. And both sides happy to be giving to the other. Both sides fulfilled in giving to the other. Okay, so this is not just... I shouldn't say it that way. I was going to say it's not just philosophy. Philosophy doesn't deserve a just. Philosophy is very important. But it's not only philosophy. It's also codified in halacha, the way things typically are. Okay. Now, yesterday we started the fourth chapter, which he's giving examples of where you can see in normal life that people have a desire to give. It's a normal and almost necessary expression of their character. So we mentioned yesterday children. Now he says, there are two reasons why people have children. One is that there should be a continuation of themselves in the world. That's not necessarily giving. That's, I want to see that my presence in the world is extended. And the other is, the children are dependent, totally dependent upon their parents. And the parents have an opportunity to give in a very profound way. Children are also desired as recipients of giving. Now he says, I'll prove to you that this concept of children's importance as the recipients of what you have to give is a genuine concept. Because, he says, you find that people who are childless, Rahman al-Nitzlan, some of them will adopt children from other family, from other parents. That's not a direct continuation of them. It's not their production. Okay, you could say that they will influence them, their development and their character, and maybe they'll carry forth their values. But then what about the ones who take in animals? Dogs, cats. And they shower love on dogs and cats. I don't know if you're aware of how far human mishigas has gone, but there are funeral parlors for dogs and cats. And there are cemeteries, and you set up, and they have wreaths that you can pay to put a wreath on the date of the death of the dog. You can come visit the grave, right? And you know, what's going on here? There's no question here of the dog carrying your identity into the future. He's going to die before you do. And a dog can't represent you in the world. It's absurd. So they're not buying these creatures and showering their love upon these creatures because they think this is my continuation in the world. But what? A person needs to give. A person needs to love. A person needs to support. They used to say in English, I don't know if we say it anymore, I'm not current with the contemporary slang, everyone needs to be needed. That's a very profound truth. Everyone needs to be needed. Because if I'm needed, then I have something to give, something to provide, something to create. And that fulfills my need to give. You must know, it's quite common that when people retire from their jobs, they go into a decline. Often a quite steep and rapid decline. Physically, mentally, emotionally. Why? Because nobody needs them. They don't need to get up in the morning. Nobody cares whether they get up or they don't get up. So how many times can he go play golf? He make a golf partnership so he is depending upon you to come and play with him, so he needs you. Oh, now I have something to get up for. My friend needs me to play golf with him. But it's all need. Health for older people who retire from their jobs. We who teach in yeshivas, we're never going to retire. We're going to be teaching until we die. But those people who retire from their jobs, it's very important to provide them with some other responsibility where they're creating something so they'll be needed so that this desire to give can find expression. Now, he raises one of the fundamental questions which this whole essay is coming to address and answer. He says, we see that love and giving come together. We give and we love. And typically, the people to whom we give are the people whom we love. Which causes which? Is it that I love these people because I love them, I'm interested in them, and I care about them, and I identify with them, and I give to them? Or is it that I give to them, and because I give to them, I love them? We are used to thinking that it's the first way. There are people for whom I naturally feel love, and of course they're the ones with whom I identify, and those are the ones to whom I give. But he says the second thought, the second concept, is also a natural concept. A person loves the work of his own hands. He loves what he creates. Because when he creates it, he feels it to be a part of himself. Whether it's a child or an adopted child or an animal or a plant that he planted or a house that he built, he's attached to the work of his hands out of love, because he sees himself in them. His self has expanded to include them. So his natural care for himself now expands to include them. And there's actually a source for this in Chazal, almost word for word, in Derech Eretz Zuta. If you want to attach yourself in love to your friend, seek his good. Act on his behalf. Do something to benefit him. And in that way, you will attach to your friend in good. This love, he says, is very deep. And we see it in the Torah itself, which he puts in parentheses here, which is the only genuine source to know the depths of the human personality, the human soul. The only source is the Torah. Not your local psychologist, and not people with human intuition. The only source to know the depths of the human soul is the Torah, because only the Creator who created the soul can reveal it to us. This is extraordinarily important. Now what do we find? The Jewish people are going to war. As the army is assembled, and before they go out to battle, there's an announcement made. Who is the person who built a house and didn't inaugurate it? Built a house and didn't inaugurate it? Go home. You don't have to fight. Who is the person who planted a vineyard and didn't inaugurate it by getting it to 4 years so you can eat the fruit? You built it, you planted it, and you didn't inaugurate it? You can go home. Who is the person who betrothed a wife and didn't complete the marriage? Let him go home. That's the Shvat Esther. Just think of what we're comparing here. We're comparing a wife, a vineyard, and a house. Shouldn't we stop and take note? Do you love a vineyard and a house the way you love a wife? Do you love a wife the way you love a vineyard and a house? What kind of comparison are they making here? The vineyard and the house you love because you made them. You created them. So your essence, your identity is in them. There's a tremendous kasha here, which I'm going to come to. There's a tremendous objection here, which I'm going to come to. I'm just saying it out now. Well, but I'm aware there's a kasha we have to deal with. So then, what you have to learn from it is, at least one dimension of your love for your wife is because of what you invest in her. Just like you love the house and the vineyard, you love the wife because of what you invest in her. And marriage has to be understood as an opportunity for mutual investment. Because through that investment, the love is built. And he said, I observed an event which confirmed this for me. Now, this was a tragic event, but he reports it. He was in England during the war and after the war. And he reports that there were young parents and they had a young child. One young child. And when the war broke out in Europe and everybody was running for their lives, it happened that the enemies separated between the members of the family. The father and the son were on one side and the mother was on the other side. And they lost track of one another. Each, of course, with terrible longings for the other. Several years they were apart till the war ended and they finally were reunited. And of course, when they were reunited, they rejoiced in being back together with one another. And now he says, and behold, it was astonishing. They couldn't repair immediately what the missing time had caused. The love of the father and the son was deep and attached, far more so than the love of the mother and the son. She left him a baby. She comes back and finds him 3 years older. It was like he's a different kid. She has to get to know him now all over again. She left him with a picture in her mind of a baby. What was she longing for all those years? My baby! Your baby's gone. There is no baby anymore. There's only this six-year-old. What's the root of it? The root of it is that the father and the son were united in that the father was providing for the son, protecting the son, caring for the son the whole time. So that the investment of giving and caring kept reinforced and strengthened the love of the father to the son. The mother lost out on that. And it took a considerable amount of time where she was reunited with the family and could now start investing in the child again to rebuild that connection. Now he brings a proof from a famous Gemara, which, it's really a Gemara in a Tosfos, which people, you know the Gemara, but people don't see the analysis all the way through. We have a law. If people are in trouble, you have to help them. In particular, imagine a person who's transporting goods from one place to another. He's using animals to transport the goods. He could be in trouble in one of two ways. Either the load on the animal has become unbalanced and the animal is struggling and the load could fall off and become damaged. And what he needs is immediate help in unloading the animal. Or you come across this traveler and the load is already on the ground and the animal is there and what he needs is help in reloading the animal. Now, you're the passerby, and he's there alone, and it's a difficult job. You're supposed to stop and help him. Suppose there are two people. One is in the first condition. His animal's struggling under the load. And the other needs help reloading his animal. And you can only help one of them, at least immediately. You can only help one of them. Which one should you choose? Sorry?
The one with the load on it.
The one with the load on it. The one that's struggling under the load. The reason is because the animal's suffering. The animal is suffering. And relieving an animal suffering is something which is a Jewish responsibility. He's quoting it here as their eisa. It's machlokes the Gemara, whether it's biblical or whether it's rabbinic. But everybody agrees you have to do that. So, you have to unload the animal that's struggling before you help load the animal where the load is on the ground. That's true. Except in one case. Where the person whose animal is struggling under its unbalanced load is someone who's a friend of yours. And the person who needs help reloading his animal is an enemy of yours. And then you have to help your enemy first. And it takes precedence over the pain of the animal. You have to help your enemy first. Says the Gemara, why? To force his evil inclination to remove the hatred from his heart. You don't like him. You think he's your enemy. You hate him. So the post can already talk about whether this is a person who's really objectively a criminal or isn't objectively a criminal and so on and so on. And if he's objectively criminal, why shouldn't you hate him? So Tosfos says maybe you're hating him too much. Okay, the details are all taken care of by the commentators. But look at what the Gemara is saying here. How are you going to overcome the hatred that's in your heart for this person? Do something for him. Help him. Because when you help him, you invest in him, you are enabling him to do something, and then you care about it. You care about his success in doing it because you're invested over there. You see yourself in his success. And just as you care for yourself, now if you think back to the first year, just as, not just as much as, but just as you care for yourself, you now care for him and his success because his success is your success. The general rule, he says, is, now listen to his words. These words led me off the track, and it took me a while to figure out the truth here. The general rule is, when one person gives to his compatriot, he doesn't lose it thereby. But this is the expansion of himself. For he will feel that he has a portion in his friend to whom he's giving. So when A gives to B, A's not losing. He said, what do you mean? I gave him $100. Am I not $100 the poorer? I'm missing the $100 now because I gave it to B. No, because you now have a $100 investment in B. You now are located in B. So you've acquired that connection to B by giving him the $100. And that's the connection between a person to somebody else, which we call love.
Does it all boil down to like stinginess coming back to me because I'm giving?
Oh, okay. This is the question. This is the question that occurred to me. I wanted to call this, I've been written in my notes here, I wanted to call it ego imperialism. Ego imperialism. I'm just spreading my ego around. You know? Suppose I could grow a third arm. Boy, would that be useful. Huh! Would that be useful? Think of all the things I could do with a third arm. Right? So now I have a third arm. It's just attached to your body. Because I gave to you, and I identify with you, and so a part of me is over there. So what you're doing is my third arm. Why isn't this just some kind of ego imperialism? Then I thought to myself, wait a minute. Couldn't this investment be mutual? Couldn't A invest in B and B invest in A simultaneously? Sure they could. I just said that 7 minutes ago about marriage, right? Of course, it could have mutual investing going on both sides. But now, if investment means ego imperialism, how are we going to calculate this? A's investing in B, so A's ego is spreading and imperializing and colonizing B. B's investing in A, so B's ego is spreading and imperializing and colonizing A. Can A imperialize B and B imperialize A? I mean, it doesn't sound like it should be a symmetrical relationship. One's got to be in charge, and the other one has to be a satellite. So I thought to myself, something's gone wrong with this analysis if I arrive at this conclusion. And then I thought about it for quite a while, and I realized that the question is based on a simple logical fallacy. When you think about a question, when you construct an argument, you have to be very careful that as you move through the whole discussion, the words all have the same meaning. If in the middle of the discussion a word changes its meaning, then the whole discussion is not valid. Now, let me put the question we're asking in very stark terms, and then I'll show you where we've made this fallacy. We've allowed a word to change its meaning. I project my self on B. So now, part of myself is found in B. Doesn't B thereby become my satellite, my colony? Look what's happened here. If I project part of myself on B, who am I now? Who am I now? I'm not just what's sitting in this chair because part of myself is over there. The self that was limited to what's sitting on this chair is not limited that way anymore. The self is now expanded to include what's on the other chair. Once you've said that, you can't go on to ask, maybe I'm imperializing him. Who's the I? Now the I has gone back to the one that's sitting in this chair. We lost that I. That I has disappeared. It's been replaced by a different I. It's a simple, what we call a fallacy of equivocation. That a word has acquired a meaning, and then further on, you forgot that it required that meaning, go back to the old meaning. Spreading the self, spreading your essence to include another, means that old self that's limited to the chair isn't there anymore. A new self has taken its place. A new self has taken its place. A little bit like this. Suppose I'm writing with a pen in my right hand, and I write the letter I. The singular first person pronoun, I. What does the word I refer to? Does it refer to my hand? It's my hand that produced it. No, we say, don't be silly. The hand produced it, but it refers to the person. I is a reference to a whole person, even though only a piece produced it. But the I refers to the whole person whose hand it is that produced it. Quite correct. The I isn't limited to this part that's in motion. The I has a bigger reference. It has a bigger reality. Okay. We're picturing, Vestas picturing the I expanding to include another body sitting on another chair. Of course, this body moves on its own and that body moves on its own. That's true. The bodies move separately. But that doesn't explain where the I is located. Just like the hand producing I doesn't limit the I to the hand. So when this body says I, the I is not necessarily limited to this body. So what happens here is this. There's a new I. This new I includes two bodies. The body that's sitting over here, the body that's sitting over there. Now, this I cares for itself. Why does it care for itself? Because as we said in the first chair, everyone is appropriate to love themselves. Self-love, we said, is appropriate. When you tell someone, love your friend as yourself, you're assuming he loves himself. If he didn't love himself, then telling him to love his friend as himself would mean, just like you love yourself zero, love him zero also. Which is clearly not what the Torah intends. But now, it's a direct transfer. This self loves, has self-love. It's concerned with itself. Now the self has expanded to include that other body, and the self still cares for itself. The self still loves itself. But now the self-love includes that other body. So the self-love, which is felt over here, it's in my psychology, this self-love, but the definition of the self includes that other body. So when this self-love that's felt in my brain, in my heart, in my soul, when this self-love acts on its own behalf, the other body is part of the behalf. The other body is part of the self on which it behaves, which it acts, because that's where the self is. The self is in the body in this chair, and the self is that very same self in the body in the other chair. So this is not imperialism. It's really the self expanding. And now it's clear the self could expand in two directions at once. A self could expand to include B, and B self could expand to include A. It's just that the caring would now expand that way. Yeah.
This goes by animals also?
You mean for a person to an animal? Let's see. Let's go back. Yes, of course. Anything in which you invest. That's what Odessa says. The comparison between the house, the vineyard, and the wife. He's talking about the dynamics of investing in something and thereby coming to identify with it and the self-spreading. There was a noted American psychologist, Jewish psychologist, named Abraham Maslow. Abraham Maslow created a theory, what he called self-actualization. Self-actualization. People who... whose lives are integrated, motivated, inspired by being built around some kind of project. He gave the example of a certain professor of psychology who put out a psychological journal all by himself. He examined all the articles and edited them, and he paid for it, and he published it, and he sent it out. And that journal, he said, was his life. That's why he got up in the morning, and that's why he worked late hours, and that's why he borrowed money to invest and had to work to pay it back. Right? And his life was filled with challenge and accomplishment and satisfaction because of that project. That project was, as they say, this is my baby. Right? That's the way people talk. As if it were a child. The self actualizes by spreading to include that other, which then becomes the object of concern. It's the same self. Well, it's the self that you started with, but it's expanded to include that other. Now, it could be, as he says, a house, or a vineyard, or a person, or a project. It doesn't make any difference. This is the example I think I gave you about the child with the grass. Right? When he comes home from school and he's told to take the seed and put it in a glass and grow it. And that grass, it's his grass. And he talks about, my grass is growing, or my grass is withering, and he's upset. You know, it's just grass. No, it's his grass. And the whole lawn outside could be withered and shriveled. If his grass is growing, he's happy. The lawn outside, it's not his. What's it got to do with me? I don't know if I told you, my wife told me about an exercise they do in certain social psychology groups. This is really astonishing. A women's group, and they tell the women, we want you to go home and take a raw egg and wrap it in something that's soft and protective and put it in your purse and carry it around with you for a week. Carry the egg around with you for a week. Good. They do that. They come to the end of the week. And the instructor says, okay, you carry it around for a week, take it home, and make a scrambled egg and eat it. The woman's reaction is, what? My egg? What do you mean, eat my egg? Right? It's just an egg, boys and girls. What are you talking about? But that, she's been protecting it. Every time the purse drops, I thought, what about my egg? Is the egg okay? Right? You know, I'll put it over here. It's a little safer over here. You know, after you've invested that kind of care, to tell the person to eat the egg is brutal, right? Even though it's just an egg. Right? That's the way we are. If you invest in something, you come to identify with it, even when it's something as trivial as an egg.
How do people sell chicken?
I'm sorry, how do people sell chicken?
Because
they don't take care of them in that way. If you ever see how eggs are produced, the chickens are treated with brutality from the word go. They're put in tiny cages. They don't get any exercise. They're filled with hormones to do. They look at them as egg factories. They're egg factories. Not even slaves. Slaves are human. They're egg factories. Well, as they say about cows, you know, it's meat on the hoof. Right? The whole attitude is not one of care. The attitude is one of, we spoke about givers and takers, right? Here's a person for whom it's only a vehicle for taking. Okay. Now, he explains what I really prepared you for, the idea of loving your friend as yourself. And as we said, it doesn't mean as much as yourself, but you're using the same dynamic of self-love to love your friend. He said, we explained in the previous chapter that everybody has a spark of giving. Why is it that everybody has a spark of giving? Because God created the world in such a way that all the selfishness in the world cannot totally obliterate the desire to give. A person could be unbalanced. A person could be on the whole a taker in particular actions. He can express only taking. But it is a necessary ingredient in every person's personality, that there's an element of giving, I told you, because you have a soul. And the soul is godlike, and God is giving and only giving. So that being the case, of course, as long as you have a soul, there's going to be an element of giving in you. Why did God set it up that way? Because if there would be only taking, if you could have people who could develop into only takers, the whole world would disappear. Now, he quotes a very interesting Gemara here. The Gemara says, were it not for the evil inclination, a person would never get married, never have children, never build a house. But the evil inclination doesn't give you a choice. Right? You have desires, you have needs, and this is the only way to fulfill them. So bang, that's what you do. Why? Why would a person never get married, never have children? Just because of evil inclination? So one interesting explanation is this. You can make it into a pious comment. Let's see. I'm trying to serve God as best I can with my life. If I get married, what will be the consequence? Well, there are tremendously difficult and sensitive laws how a man has to treat his wife. Then there are responsibilities for your children. And if you have children and you have a wife, you need income. And if you need income, then you have to go out to work. And working is difficult and competitive, and there are all sorts of laws that how can you work and how you can't work. You can be guilty of fraud and misrepresentation, all the rest. The person will say, what do I need all of this for? What do I need all of this for? Okay, there's a mitzvah to get married and have children. That's true. But look at all the other mitzvahs that I will inevitably compromise by putting myself in this position. Wouldn't I be better off religiously by not getting married? True, I'm violating a particular mitzvah, but all the other mitzvahs I'll protect. I won't get married. My needs will be very minimal. I'll live in a one-room thing. Spend my time studying Torah. I'll be guilty of one crime, but I'll protect myself from all those other crimes. It's a very frum cheshbon, right? Good. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, comes along and says, sorry, not giving you a choice. The Sefer Avodah Zarah says that one of the key motivations for having children is to give. That's part of what motivates you. The Gemara calls it the evil inclination. He's pointing out another side to the motivation. And he's saying that if a person could become a pure taker, then indeed, getting married might not be the best option for him. Think of our friendly enemies, the evolutionary biologists, who will tell you that a man's biological interest is spreading his genes and spreading them as far and wide as possible. And if marriage is going to limit him, forget it. And he has no interest in raising the children. He's spreading his genes. The more he can spread, the better off he is. So living a life of freedom, a Don Juan life, according to them, would be the most successful life in terms of biological, the motivations built into the organism through evolution. One of the cautious in evolution is that people don't behave that way. That people want to have families. And people want to be investing in the care of the children and so forth and so on. So if that says another reason why, if it were not for this desire to give, if the world were only takers, then I'm investing in having a family and all those responsibilities, which requires a tremendous investment of time and effort, many people would not be motivated to do that. But the family is a vehicle for giving. And because we are strongly motivated to give, that's why we invest in families. One of the reasons why we invest in families. So now he says, what you see from this is that the one to whom you give is the one that you will love. And therefore, when you look at the world and you say, I love these people, and that person is a stranger, what you're really saying is, these are people in whom I've invested, and that's a person I haven't invested in yet. It's not as if there's some kind of natural barrier. Well, I'm naturally drawn to these people, not naturally drawn to those people. Our personalities are compatible or incompatible. Doesn't matter. If you would invest in that person, then you'd become attached to that person in the love that comes from expanding your ego to include that person.
Yeah, I think that we're saying that the main love comes from giving. I think that all kids, children, do not love their parents. They hate their parents. It's just getting.
Okay, you ask, if love comes from giving, then how can children love their parents? There are two things to be said here. He didn't say all love comes from. He's talking about the truest and the deepest love, and the love that the Torah is talking about when it says you should love your neighbor, your friend as yourself. But guess what? One of the reasons, as you'll discover when you're a parent, one of the reasons that children love their parents is because parents give plenty of opportunities for the children to give to them. Please help me with this. Please, the mother will say to the daughter, let's bake a cake together. And then the cake is baked, and the father comes home and says, you see, she mixed it, and she gave me all the ingredients. We made it together. Isn't that wonderful? And the child feels important. The child feels like the child has something to give. Right? Help me clean up, the mother will say to the children. Help me clean up so that the house will be ready for the guests. And then she says, thank you for helping me clean up. Could she have done it herself? Maybe so, but if she's smart, she won't do it that way. Right? It's like the example I gave you of the picture that the child paints in kindergarten, comes home and the parent says, oh, wow, you made that for me. I'm putting it up. You know, I have a digital camera. I'll take the digital picture. I'll send it an email to the grandparents. They'll see the picture. How does the child feel? Child feels, I provided something. I gave something. So that is a large part of the love that the children feel for the parents. That's true. What you're saying is also true. Hakaras HaTov, gratitude. Gratitude, especially when I receive something from somebody who does it as an expression of love, will motivate me to love the person as well. But that is one type of love. And vis-a-vis this, it's a low-level type of love. What you should ask as an extension of your question is, and he actually asked this, we'll come to it next time, or the time after, Mitzvah Hashem. Can this be applied to love of God? Okay, you took children and parents, right? I said, with children and parents, the parent gives the child an opportunity. Can we talk about really giving something to God and thereby attaching ourselves to God that way? And if Esther wants to say yes, it applies even vis-a-vis a person's relationship with God. You want to say something?
When he gives it to his parents and he goes to sleep at 8 o'clock, he feels like he's giving it to his parents also. He feels like he's giving it, like, they want me to do this, I'll do it. It sounds like he feels like, okay, I'll listen to it.
Let's see, let's think about that for a second. Obedience. The parent says, I want you to do this, and the child does it. So, I think that's probably right. Even though, in truth, the parent is telling the child to do it because it's good for the child. But the child doesn't think of it that way. He experiences it. The parent asks this of me, and I'm doing what the parent wants, so therefore I'm giving something to the parent. I think that's right. Okay, except that there I'm talking about the limited psychology of the child. Right? Now the question is whether that applies vis-a-vis God. We'll see that in the session next time.
We say that children are giving something to the parents because the parents need to love someone and get someone to give to.
Yes.
So that itself is the reason. And that would be the same thing as whatever the reason God created the world. We're doing God in the same way parent-child.
Well, yes and no.